Just a note before we start. Our show talks about touchy subjects that may be difficult for some of our listeners. Take care of yourself. If you feel you need to seek help, see the links at the end of our show notes for resources.
Welcome to Touchy Subjects, the podcast that aims to make those awkward conversations around domestic and sexual violence just a little less awkward. I'm Sean.
I'm Allie.
And I'm Amanda.
And today we're going to be discussing implicit bias, and we have a special guest with us, Megan Sweet. So Megan, could you just please introduce yourself to our audience?
Sure. My name is Megan Sweet. I'm a career educator. I live out here in California, and I have been dedicating my life to transforming our educational settings, and implicit bias plays a big role in what's happening in our schools. So I'm happy to talk with you today.
Yeah, we're happy to have you. This is a subject that we haven't really touched on the podcast yet. And we know that it is prevalent in all schools. And, you know, social issues like implicit bias, while they may not, directly be under the umbrella of domestic or sexual violence, it still affects the way that we're able to reach communities. It affects the way that we are serving communities. It affects the way that domestic and sexual violence are viewed by society. And so we're really, really excited to be able to talk about this with somebody whose work is all about it. So, before we get into the meat of this, can you give us kind of a basic definition of what implicit bias is?
Sure. Implicit biases are biases that we don't necessarily choose or pick up. They're ones that we kind of have that influence the way that we're seeing things without making an overt choice to have a bias. Like, and maybe an example would be, I'm not a fan of okra. I have a bias against okra because I've eaten it and I don't like it. So that would be a more overt bias. You're making an intentional choice. Implicit bias is the influence that you get that changes the way that you see things that you might not necessarily be choosing it. No one at one time gave me a lot of information that okra was a bad vegetable to eat. But with implicit bias, it's those cues and messages that we hear about people all the time, often about people, it could be about things, but about people that are kind of born from our societal experiences and choices, societal experiences. So we are in the United States, we were founded basically colonizers coming in and decided that the native people that were here needed to be moved out, that the people that came decided that they were superior. And then we brought in slaves. And then we've had all these policies over time that have been intentionally targeting different subgroups of people, positioning them as less than or inferior to in one way or another to the white colonizing culture that was here. Those messages are in they're like in the air we breathe and the water we swim in, and those influence us whether or not we choose them. So we're not necessarily picking and choosing to have a bias against anyone, but because of all the messages we get, we're influenced by those biases anyways. And that's what an implicit bias is. I know that's a long description, but maybe helpful, because I think oftentimes folks struggle with implicit bias because they don't agree with the biases that they have, or they're actually their intentional thoughts are against those biases, but those implicit biases are there anyways influencing them. And that's what makes them tricky.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It sounds like, too, just to use like that food analogy for like the okra, I for a very long time just never liked green beans because I was told that green beans just suck and are not a like tasty thing to eat. So I just assumed that they were bad. So I never even tried to eat green beans. So I don't know if that helps try to make that distinction between the explicit and implicit biases for our listeners, if they wanted a very short and condensed version. But like you were saying, Megan, we all have implicit biases. It's like we're never going to be immune to having them because the policies in our country have been basically founded on some of those biases to begin with.
Exactly.
So when we're trying to focus on having discussions around bias or helping talk about like stereotypes and stuff, it's often people will, they won't, they'll shy back or they'll like get defensive when having these discussions because they're like, oh no, I don't like that. Like you said, Megan, like they don't like the biases that they have, or they don't agree, or they don't see them having those biases. But all of us, even all four of us here, have biases that we have to work towards recognizing or work towards not allowing us to kind of sit on that cruise control to just say like, oh, yep, this is how I'm going to interact with them because these are the biases I have towards them. And these are the stereotypes that I think they fit.
Yeah, I think that's a great, I think that's exactly right. And actually my suspicion about Okra started with Fraggle Rock. I think this is probably older than all of you, but it was a Muppet show and they all hated Okra on Fraggle Rock. And that's what I grew up watching. So I had a suspicion of Okra, and then I actually ate it and decided I didn't like it. So my implicit bias against Okra became an explicit bias once I tasted Okra and decided it wasn't for me. But you're right. Implicit biases are everywhere. They're a reflection of our society norms and values and the messages we get in the media, in our history books, in our newspapers, the way people are represented in police cases, and absolutely when we interact with folks that are in crisis. They happen in our classroom. They happen everywhere because we get so many messages that are reinforcing those biases, and we're subconsciously picking them up and they're influencing us. So you're exactly right, Sean. You have to start becoming aware that they're there and having a willingness to acknowledge that they're there. When we fight against them because intellectually or intentionally we don't want to have that bias and that feels either shameful or difficult, all it does actually is it prevents us from being able to address it. So I think we all just have to normalize that all of us have biases and we have them against ourselves. So I wrote a book because we often talk about implicit bias around race and identity, and that's really important, but it's also around things like gender and other things. And so an example of an implicit bias that I still have, I have to work with regularly, are what are the roles that are appropriate for women? And so in my book, like if I think of a colonel of the army, I don't think of a woman in that role. I almost always think of the stereotypical like alpha male kind of character. Often my mind goes to a white identified male character because that's what I've seen in movies for now almost 5 decades, right? Like through my lifetime, that's the image of what a colonel in the army looks like. And so it takes me a minute to be like, oh, right, a woman could be a colonel of the army. Well, of course a woman could be a colonel of the army. Like I believe women can do anything and are just as capable. But I have that, it takes me a beat to kind of catch that, notice it, and work with it. And that's what it requires for us to start to unpack implicit biases is having a willingness to know that they're there and how they're influencing how we're seeing ourselves or others.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. There's, you know, there's a lot of, phrases that people get very defensive about. And I think this bias is one of them, gender norms, like all of these kind of buzzwords that have been used somewhat incorrectly, I think, en masse. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is that people hear these things and they immediately get defensive. And when we have conversations around implicit bias in the workplace or, you know, in the media, a lot of those times we're talking about race, as you mentioned, right? And so people automatically think implicit bias means racism. I am not a racist, right? So therefore, I cannot have implicit biases in my own head, in my schemas. But what you just illustrated that, you know, those small things, when you think of a colonel in the military, do you think of a man, a white identified, probably cisgender heterosexual man? Probably. That's a very small implicit bias. And in itself, that doesn't mean that you're sexist, right? Mm-hmm. But when we have, you think about how many times you have those small, tiny little thoughts every single day. They build and they build and they build and they build until your belief system mirrors those implicit biases, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, whether or not you even choose to take them on. So I think that's why it's important to have the willingness to interrogate them and acknowledge that those biases are there because they're influencing us anyway. And so we can make a choice to acknowledge that they're there and make an adjustment. And that means constant vigilance. There's a movie I can't remember the movie where that's the constant vigilance, but that's what it requires, is constantly being aware of the thoughts that are in our minds and staying curious and open both to the thoughts that are there, but also whether or not they're true.
Yeah.
And we're just influenced all the time. So it requires that we constantly pay attention to that and acknowledge it so we can make a different choice. Otherwise, we're being influenced by it anyway. And not only are we influenced by it, but then we're putting those biases on others. And that creates a lot of harm for the people that are experiencing, constant implicit bias. Sometimes we call those microaggressions or macroaggressions, right? So those small little biases or assumptions that we make about people based on their identity often become these like assumptions that we utter or act on. Sometimes it like intentionally or, but often unintentionally. And those are those microaggressions that when you're a person that has a lot of identities that have not been supported or that have been actually attacked in our country, then the weight of that as you move through your life is profound. And just in a day-to-day basis, what that looks like and feels like is really difficult. And that's why we need to pay attention to it.
Yeah. In one of the trainings that I do a lot, it's typically framed around a discussion of human trafficking, where we will discuss kind of like how stereotypes, how we place stereotypes or biases on different groups of people, and that placing these biases or stereotypes on them creates marginalization. So we start pushing groups that are not the focal point further and further out, and that creates more vulnerabilities then to becoming a victim of human trafficking, but also in terms of dating violence, sexual assault, any form of victimization. The more we marginalize people, the more likely they are, or the greater risk they are for having violence perpetrated against them. And one of the things I always mention in it is that we all have stereotypes, we all have these biases, because as humans, we take in a lot of information every day. So if we had to cognitively focus and think about everything that we were experiencing, everybody we were interacting with, we wouldn't be able to function. So we have these biases and stereotypes created because it gives us almost like a roadmap. Or we can kind of like quickly navigate this conversation this way in order to just basically go about our days. So like these stereotypes and these biases have like created almost like a place, because it creates quicker discussions or makes it so we can get out of conversations quicker if we don't want to be in them. But when we sit on that cruise control, or we allow those stereotypes to dictate how we interact with everybody that we have placed in that group, that's when it starts to create a problem, because now we're not seeing those people for who they actually are. We are seeing them for basically a caricature that we have created for whoever we have placed in that box.
Yeah, that's a really great point. When you were talking, something that came up for me, and I can't remember the study right now, and I'm probably going to mangle it a little bit, but go with me, and it's close enough, I hope, which is that there was a study that measured our willingness. It was a poke test. So it was a scientific study to see people, and you might have heard about this, but a willingness to kind of people's mental responses to watching other people be poked with a pin. So and our pain receptors and our kind of emotional response, that what they were measuring was people's emotional responses to people being poked by a pin. But what they were also measuring was based on different identity types. And essentially what this scientific study showed is that we're most likely to have this mirror or this kind of like empathetic response towards people that look like us and share identities to us. And that decreases with people that are different from us. So that's what's really important about what you're naming there, is that if we see ourselves as different from other people, or it's not me, it's not my problem, it's a they or a them, when we make those distances, it makes it really hard for us to have the empathy and the desire to take action or to provide support for others in that way. And you're right, our brains process millions of bits of information. And so it's looking for things that are gonna it actively looks for things that reinforce our biases, because that creates a sense of safety and control and comfort. So we have to be, that's why we have to be vigilant, because otherwise it's gonna keep giving us information that reinforces some of the things that we didn't choose. And implicit bias is one of those things that we didn't choose to have, but we're getting messages and getting information sorted and filtered through to reinforce those biases. So That's why we have to pay attention to them.
Right. And I think it's important to note, too, that just some of these things that our body is automatically doing, there was a purpose for it at some point. You know, this implicit bias comes up because, you know, if you saw a bear in the woods, you automatically have this thing that tells you, okay, this is going to be scary. This is dangerous. I need to do these things to get out of this situation. That bear might not be hungry. He might not want to try and eat you, but we have so ingrained in us that a bear is going to attack us that we react that way. And like I said, that was an important feature in the human mindset through evolution. But now we've taken that and we've kind of twisted it into just these everyday interactions we have with other people.
Yeah, that's such a great point. I was thinking about that too, right? So right, our ability, our brain is, what is doing that filtering is exactly what you're saying. It's scanning for the unfamiliar, because the unfamiliar in olden times, and this is back like when we were living more in nature, was helping us to, without us having to consciously be aware of it, our brain was looking for things that were unfamiliar that would let us know that we could be in trouble and that would ready our body for fight, flight, or freeze, right? So that was to get us out of that situation. And now that scanning for the unfamiliar is, it shows up around the, you know, for looking for threats, shows up around things like emails or, you know, people that look or are different than us, because that's what our world is looks like now. And what's really important to understand about this from an instructional point of view, and what I talk to educators about all the time, is there's actually studies that show that, so when that fight, flight, freeze thing happens, right? And when that happens, when we're scanning and a bear is there, what happens is our cognitive brain shuts down because it's not needed right now. So that kind of thinking brain shuts down and our body readies to protect itself. So our pupils dilate, we get a flood of like adrenaline and other hormones go through. But basically our body readies to fight. Now we have that same response to perceived threats that are different. That are around actually identity a lot. So there are studies that show that kids whose cultural identities are not respected or supported in the classroom, and even worse, when they experience those microaggressions or examples of implicit bias, they go into fight, flight, freeze mode in the classroom, mm-hmm. which means that their learning, their ability to learn is shut down because they're experiencing a classroom that feels unsafe for them because their culture and their identity aren't safe and supported in that space. So imagine teachers that are, for the most part, I'd say every teacher enters the classroom almost exclusively with the intention to do good and to be supportive and nurturing and to empower kids. But if you're not paying attention to all those different places where implicit bias is showing up, in how you're talking with kids and how you're making assumptions about kids and their learning, or in your field, when you're supporting people that are the victims of domestic abuse, then you're actually causing even further harm to people that you're trying to show up to provide support for. And for teachers, you're actually undermining your own efforts to teach them because you're shutting off their ability to learn effectively by creating classroom environments that don't feel safe and inclusive for kids. And that's why it's so important for those of us that are in fields that are, providing service and that are working with others, that we really pay attention to those biases, because we're often causing harm to the people that we're there to serve. And that's really important to pay attention to.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I mean, it's further proof that as people who are educating, as we're doing our outreach and our education, our prevention, that's something we need to be mindful of. But it's something that the general population needs to be mindful of too. And I got a pen and paper out as you were talking, because I didn't want to forget this. And I'm sure I had like a deja vu. I'm almost 100% sure one of our other guests in the past like 6 months has had this phrase of staying curious. Mm-hmm. And every time I hear it, it resonates with me. You said, stay curious and open. And I think that is like the most crucial phrase when we're talking about this, because we're not trying to punish ourselves for having implicit bias, okay? We're not trying to have our listeners punish themselves for having these implicit biases. And it can show up like that, right? If I'm in, say, an inner city neighborhood and I recognize myself stereotyping, or I recognize myself having these implicit biases, there's 100% a tendency for me to go, you shouldn't be doing that. Why would you do that? Like that's not true. And admonish myself for that. Right. But instead, if I stay curious and open, I can say, Ellie, like, what's going on here? Why are you feeling this way? Why are you behaving this way? Why are you seeing that person over there in the way that you are? And I think that is where we all begin to dismantle the system of implicit bias, is when we start to feel it in ourselves, instead of pushing it away, saying, oh no, I don't have biases in this moment. No, I do. I do. It's okay to acknowledge that. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that talking about these schemas, right? And schemas are ways that our brains organize and store information. And again, they have an evolutionary purpose. They have a purpose in our everyday lives now. It's like having all of your silverware in the same drawer in your kitchen, right? You know exactly where it is. You don't have to think about it anymore. When you move houses, you're going to have to think about it and build that muscle memory back up again. But for now, you know where it is. That's mm-hmm. what schemas do. And they help us process information quicker. Mm-hmm. But when we are educating, if we are on that autopilot that Sean was talking about, and we're not addressing those schemas, and we're not addressing if we're not being present in the moment, it can be really harmful. And so I just wanted to make note of those two things, because I love the phrase, stay curious and open. And I also think that in education, those schemas need to be addressed.
Yeah, well, curious is such a great word. It's one of my favorite words, because it is open and it doesn't have judgment in it, right? So judging ourselves isn't going to help us. In fact, it's more likely to keep us frozen and holding on to the very beliefs that we're judging ourselves for having. So it doesn't serve a purpose. So we should just stop doing it if we can. I know it's hard. But there's actually some great research that's, and I talk with educators a lot about it, called mindful self-compassion, or just self-compassion in general. Which basically means that we meet ourselves with care and kindness when we make a mistake, rather than with judgment. And there is proof that shows that when we meet ourselves with that kind of kindness, we actually are able to change a lot more quickly. I don't want to mistake that with like white fragility and other things, because I think that's where those two things can get kind of mixed together. And as a white identified person, I have to always be aware of that. It doesn't mean it's not painful to acknowledge that I have a bias. And even I can have feelings of shame. Even talking about it now, I worry that I'm saying it wrong and I'm going to cause harm just from this conversation. Like that's what it is to be in these spaces. So we just have to kind of choose to be uncomfortable in having these kinds of conversations and making mistakes. Because you're right. And we have to stay curious about that. Like, oh, okay, why am I, if I put myself back in the classroom, why am I having, I have to look at the data. Am I having problems with all kids from a certain identity? Am I, I actually have to often check myself when working with women. I have a lot of expectations around women that I have to pay attention to and make sure that I'm being inclusive. So I think it doesn't really matter what your environment is, but just paying attention to what those thoughts are and then being curious. I had a friend who modeled it really beautifully once, where she was, she acknowledged that she had a bias and she was and that it was influencing the way she was seeing someone. She goes like, see, look at how my brain is doing that. Look what my brain did. It made this association and that wasn't appropriate and I'm sorry. And it was just that simple. Like, okay, it happened. I'm gonna acknowledge that it happened and now I can take it. And she's like, now I can make an adjustment now. So it's just choosing to constantly do that. And we don't have to even utter that out loud. We can say that inside of our heads. But if it's with curiosity and with some of that gentleness, it actually makes a bigger difference. So again, not indulgence, but kindness. And I think that's the difference that sometimes throws people off.
Mm-hmm. And I want to point out too in there, because one of the things that I've struggled with a lot just doing the work that we do is I am a cisgender, straight white dude having discussions around domestic and sexual violence and gender roles and basically everything that if you saw a straight white dude talking about, you're like, he's probably overstepping. It's something that I struggle with a lot, but through conversations that I've had with a lot of other professionals is that it's, while yes, you're not going to be the poster child for how we expect to have these conversations or who we expect to be doing it. By you doing it, you're also able to admit to the biases that you've had and help other people understand that just because you have these biases, because I mention it all the time to my students, it's like, I'm not going to be able to stand up here and tell you that I've never told a sexist joke or that I've had poor viewpoints about women, because specifically as a straight white dude growing up in America, like, we learn a lot of things about women. So pointing out those biases that we've had, having discussions about how we can work on overcoming those biases is really important, because I get to at least have conversations with people then who have similar biases to what I have. So I can help them work towards creating that moment where they can overcome those biases or not allow them to dictate how they're interacting with people. Sure, as a straight white guy, I'm probably going to say things that are going to be incorrect or wrong. I recognize that, but it's being willing to hear that from other people and say, okay, yeah, you're right. I did make a mistake. Let me correct my language so I don't make that mistake again.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I think people often, and it's fearful. It's hard to take a risk and step into this conversation. And I'm assuming we're all white identified folks here based on what I'm seeing. And so for white identified folks, it can be really challenging to step into this space because we don't want to cause harm, and we're aware that we're causing harm, and often aware that we're causing harm in ways that we don't know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you add being a straight cisgender male on top of that, it can feel really challenging to step into any conversation. And then there's a desire to pull back and not engage because I don't want to cause further harm, right? I think that's a really natural response. But learning how to work with ourselves first. So I'd say that, and you've clearly done this, but I'd say that the first step for folks, if they want to start engaging in this conversation, is to do our own homework. So I think where we start to go wrong as white identified folks wanting to be anti-racist or anti-bias is we start putting the work on the people that are experiencing the biases to help us, right? So let me find somebody with identity different than mine and have them school me or help me understand what it is to be them so that I can have that conversation. So the first step is for us to start doing our own homework, doing our own reading, doing our own discussion, you know, like starting to have some understanding. You know, there's plenty of books around bias that can be helpful. And then starting to take that risk and being open to feedback when we make a mistake, but continue to have it be about us working on ourselves rather than asking others to give us, you know, to train us about what it is to be somebody who is underrepresented, I think is really important. And just knowing that we're going to make mistakes and just being really humble about it. That's another reason why I think curiosity is helpful is, you know, we're going to make mistakes. And if we're humble about it and open to listening and learning, then we can also repair. But if we make mistakes and then get really defensive about it, then actually we're doing further harm.
Yeah. And I think a step that is important for people to understand too is that you will never arrive. There is not a finish line of saying, yes, I have conquered all of my biases. I am now the perfect person to be able to interact with anyone. It's like, you're never going to arrive. So you have to stay, like we said, to stay curious, but you also have to stay willing to admit when you make a mistake, because you're going to make mistakes. We all make mistakes all the time. But if you think like, okay, I've done my homework, I've done my research, I now know how to navigate these conversations or navigate interacting with people. When you make the mistake and someone calls you out on it or says, hey, maybe you shouldn't say that, you get defensive. You say, I've already done the work. Like, you're looking too far into what I'm saying, or you're trying to make me out to be the bad guy or incorrect in what I'm saying. Like, I've already done the work. It's like, no, you have to still be willing to listen to what people are telling you, because there is no finish line.
There's always something to learn. And whether or not it's still learning what's going on right now or continuing to learn as things change. I do a lot of, spend a lot of time with like the LGBTQ community, and things are constantly changing. What was an acceptable term 10 years ago is no longer an acceptable term. And to just say, okay, I learned this and this is what I'm going with, you can't do it. You have to be willing to stay up to date, to keep in the know, and to realize that that's not right anymore. And if you can't look back at things that you have said in the past and maybe cringe a little bit at it, then you're not growing.
Yeah, what you said reminded me. I've been listening to Kevin Hart has a new podcast called Comedy Goldmine. So he doesn't need any more plugs, but I'll give him one. And what's interesting is he's been talking with a lot of comics, and you know, and they've been reflecting on a lot of there's a shelf life, and a lot of their a lot of their jokes don't play out well. I certainly am. I'm almost 50, and the movies and the TV shows that I watched when I was a kid, if I look at them now, I'm shocked and appalled at what I saw and what was a norm then. And so you're right. We have to constantly stay curious, and it can be painful. It's painful. I can't say that I'm always like, when someone tells me I've caused harm or I've said something that's harmful, that I'm like, yeah, let's talk about that. I mean, it's still me working with my own shame and my own response and my own, anxiety around that. But I now know that I can survive that, and that I can actually am always better for it on the other end. So I'm able to ride the difficult emotions that come with making a mistake. Right. But I don't want to say that making a mistake doesn't hurt. It just means that we learn how to navigate it.
Yeah, I think that there's been a lot of that actually in comedy lately. I was listening to a podcast recently that spiraled me into a rabbit hole. But the podcast itself was on Paris Hilton, and her, it's called Even the Rich, I think, is the podcast. And it was a really interesting series on Paris Hilton. And in one point, this is what spiraled me into this rabbit hole, was the podcast hosts talked about Sarah Silverman making a joke at Paris Hilton's expense while she was in the audience of a show that night, because she was, going to jail for her DUI. And it was distasteful. It was sexist. It played on a lot of stereotypes of who Paris Hilton was. And recently Sarah Silverman issued a very public apology for that. And she said, I will not be perfect. And I have done some off color comedy in the past. And I am sorry. I am sorry for that. I'm sorry to that person. And I'm sorry to the people that heard it for what I perpetuated with that. And I think that that's a really powerful, because I mean, coming from, I don't know how Sarah Silverman happens to be a person where I felt like that apology might not ever happen. Right. But here we are. I also think in this conversation of staying curious and being willing to update our own information, is the idea that, as people in this field, we want to say that we are allies. We are allies to the LGBTQ community. We are allies to the Black community. We're allies to immigrants and all of these things. But being an ally, you can't just be. You have to strive for allyship. It's not something, like Sean said, that you arrive at. I actually took a sticker down. I had an ally sticker, an LGBTQ ally sticker in my office, and I took it down because it felt too definitive to me. It felt like I was giving that label to myself when I still have work to do to act in allied ways towards the LGBTQ community. I don't identify with that community, and I didn't feel like that was a label I could give myself. And so there's also that element of it when we're talking about relearning some information, making sure that we don't ever think that we're perfect at this, and that we can do better. But underneath all of that, listening to those who are in that identity or those that we have biases against, to see how we are doing in their opinion, right? In their, in their world.
So I think it's really interesting that you just brought that up, Allie, because I actually recently had a conversation with a friend who said that, you don't get to choose if you're an ally. The person that's, being marginalized, they get to decide if you're an ally, because they get to decide if you are someone that they feel comfortable with, if you are someone that they feel will stand up for them. That's not a label that we can put on ourselves.
Well, that's, I mean, I think what you're both saying makes a lot of sense, and it's come up a lot around the Black Lives Matter movement as well, right? And you know, it's probably different terms. What I call is like performative allyship, or showing, and not that you were doing that, Allie, but like often we think that if we put the flag up, or we're saying that we're an ally in this way, we're designating ourselves as someone who's safe. But if we're actually not willing to act on it, so Sarah Silverman was on Kevin Hart's show, and she was one of the ones that I was referencing. If we're not willing to act on it by publicly naming when we've made a mistake, by naming why it was a mistake and acting in ways as being an ally, then we don't, you know, we can say inside we feel that way, but we also have to kind of step into the discomfort of that and actually act in a way that demonstrates allyship so that people can feel safe and comfortable. There's a really interesting organization that came up out of within the last year or so out of the incident, you know, of the murder of George Floyd. It's called A Long Talk About, you know, Uncomfortable Conversations. And essentially it's, we need to learn how to start having conversations with other people, how to disrupt bias when we hear it. And not in a combative way necessarily, but in like a, hey, you know, did you know when you said this thing, this is how other people could feel, or as somebody who has that identity, here's what I feel like. But it's actually being willing to have a conversation and break down individual by individual. Again, not in a way that can feel like we're putting everybody on blast all the time, but in like a, hey, did you know, or that term feels out of date, or it's sometimes really inactive, more visual and verbal ways. Like, I think it depends on the moment, but to actually act as an ally, to create space, to disrupt bias when we hear it, to make space at the table, and to name that it's not right that there isn't space at the table for everybody. So those are ways that we can be allies and demonstrate it without giving ourselves that category. Cause I think that's right. We might think we're being an ally and we're not necessarily.
Right. Yeah. I mean, believe me, I really wanted to keep that sticker up because my name is Allie, right? Like, I wanted it to be nice and tidy and I loved it, but I was like, I can't in good conscience give myself that title. I can't, even though I strive for that, I will continue to strive for that until the day I die. I don't think that that's something I can define myself as. That's not my place. So, yeah, I really appreciate that. And this conversation shows up in so many places, right? It shows up in for everything from our everyday conversations with our significant others, our children, our aunts, our uncles, maybe our parents or grandparents, because those can be really difficult conversations sometimes. But it also shows up in our work, whether your field is, you know, whether you're in the corporate world, whether you're in manual labor or nonprofit or government work like us, you have to, if you are well-intentioned in your work, you need to be paying attention to your biases. If you want to not harm people, you have to pay attention to your biases. And so I think that that is ever more present in a field like domestic and sexual violence, where we're already fighting against stereotype on stereotype on stereotype, what violence victims look and feel like, right? What they experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually just had that conversation with my son yesterday. I don't even know where it came from for him, but he was like, I guess he and his friends were debating, should a man that's a victim of sexual violence or domestic abuse be allowed to live in a home that's made for domestic violence and abuse survivors? And generally, my mind also goes to women and children in that category. And there are also men that go that are also victims of that. But again, that's in your field, I would say that's probably a pretty big bias or stereotype that is there, right? That we assume it's women. And it was an interesting conversation, and I didn't have a good answer for him, because I was like, well, I think it depends, right? I think often, you know, genders are separated in that way, because if a woman's experienced domestic violence from a man, then living in space with a man would be really difficult and painful. But you're right, where do men go if they need somewhere to go? So you're right, it's a really difficult space, but you're right, it's the conversation, so we can understand and unpack those different influences and start to understand what might be true for someone else is what's important, both within ourselves, but then when we can with others.
Hey, and to say, I don't know that answer.
Yep.
That's okay. Just like you said, I don't know that answer, but I'll try to find it out. Or I don't know that answer. Let's wrap this out. Let's try to figure it out. And that's that staying curious thing. I swear I'm going to get a sign that says stay curious and put it in my office because this is, that's profound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just this whole conversation too. The only thing that keeps ringing in my head, and I know I'm jumping back like a couple minutes in the discussion, but the only thing in my, cause my brain's weird and I couldn't focus on anything else since that point, but I love Game of Thrones. And there's a quote from Game of Thrones that is probably one of my favorite quotes from any TV series or movie. And it's from Tywin Lannister when he's talking to Joffrey, and he says, any king who has to say that they are the true king is no true king. It's focusing on allyship. It's like, if you just say you're an ally, but you're just doing the performative stuff, you're no real ally. If you're trying to do any kind of work with people and you have to continually reassure yourself that yes, I'm doing good things, but you're not willing to work on it or go any further than where you're at, you're not doing any good. So just a quick question then for you, Megan, before we try to wrap things up. What are some steps that our listeners can take to work on continuing that journey of understanding their biases and understanding how to recognize those things? So that way they are having the interactions with people that they want to have and not allowing those biases to kind of like take over.
Yeah. This might not seem like the obvious one, but I'd start with developing a mindfulness practice or something like that. What we want to start to do is become more aware of the thoughts that are running in our head, which means that we need to practice having our brains and our bodies being in the same place at the same time, which is actually incredibly difficult for us as humans, but we need to start doing that. So mindfulness practices can help. Anything that helps you to be embodied, which means, like, again, head and body are in the same place at the same time. Commit to curiosity is a big one, like of just being curious to what's there and being open to it. Trying to meet what you find there with some compassion and some in a desire to understand and to grow rather than with judgment. And then do your own homework. I think that's just really important that no matter what your identity is, we all have biases. So we got to figure out what our homework is to do. Since we're all white identified, that's how I've been kind of leaning in this conversation. But as white folks, we have a lot, as people of part of a white supremacist culture and the benefactors of a white supremacist culture, there's a lot for us to learn and stay curious about. So I love your example, Allie, of like, well, I don't think I get to claim myself as an ally, but I can keep working at it. So it's, you know, there's plenty of books now out there that can be incredibly powerful to help us to start to learn in that way. I'm a book-oriented person, but there are podcasts. But start learning our own history, I think, is a helpful place to start. So we understand how the United States was formed and why some of these biases are here, or why some folks within our community have been not represented in the way that they deserve to be. I think those could be ways to begin. And start working with yourself first.
And I want to add, we had talked about this at my work a little while ago. And one of the greatest things that we can do is we do have to take care of ourselves, because you talk about how like this bias is kind of like an autopilot. So once you start getting stressed out at work, you're overworked, you're burned out, your body automatically is going to revert to that implicit bias. And then you're going to make decisions that are more harmful than good without even realizing it. So that was just a conversation that we'd had.
Yeah, I love it. I totally agree. Especially for folks that are in fields where we're giving so much of ourselves, it's really counterintuitive to take care of ourselves as well. And sometimes it even feels selfish, or like educated will feel like it's disrespectful or wrong, mm-hmm. To like prioritize taking care of ourselves. But you're exactly right. If we make ourselves so tired or so depleted, then you're right, we run on autopilot and we're more likely to cause harm, even though that's not our intention. So absolutely, valuing and taking care of ourselves, finding 10, 15 minutes a day, even just to like do something for ourselves, can be a powerful shift without having to get into any of the heady or more meeting stuff about looking at our biases. Just taking care of ourselves on a neutral ground is a great place to start. Yeah.
And I think the one thing that I would add to it is we mentioned it a little bit earlier, but when you have that moment where your implicit bias does take over, not giving yourself like too much crap or not trying to be too hard on yourself, because just coming from an educator standpoint, if I'm saying things to my audience, if they've said something to where I make them shut down, so I say something that makes it so like, oh, well, I just, oh, you shouldn't have said that. That's bad. Well, now I've made that person feel bad for what they've said. I've shut them down. They're no longer going to learn from what I'm saying or having that teachable moment to where they can work towards overcoming what they've said or that bias. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happens to us. If I say something where my implicit bias takes over and I give myself crap for it or I make myself feel bad for what I've said, I now have just put shame on myself instead of allowing me to say, okay, I shouldn't have said that. This is probably how I can navigate that further in the future so I don't make the same mistake. Giving yourself that little bit of leeway just so you're not shutting yourself down and not making it so you don't learn from those mistakes. And again, like you said earlier, Megan, that's not to make excuses for white fragility and like all the other stuff. So also keeping in mind like where that line really is for you so you don't just make justifications for yourself every time you mess up. But
no, I think that you're right. I think it's about being compassionate, and then also when possible, doing repair. So the Sarah Silverman example is a really good example of that, of like, okay, this happened. I'm sorry. Here's, you know, I made a mistake, and when possible, you know, repairing that harm with others. We can't always do that, but when we can, I think it's important. And it's hard. I'm sure Sarah Silverman, that was a hard one. But it's what we need to do in a way that then helps people feel seen and honored and supported. And it gets easier also, the more we actually take responsibility and get into that discomfort, you know, that uncomfortable place, the more we can actually do it. And it, again, it helps us to retrain those patterns, which is what we want to do.
So, thank you, Megan, for joining us today. This conversation was amazing. I'm sure we'll find a way to have you back for something else in the future. But before we close out, do you have any socials or anything you want to plug to our listeners?
Yeah, you know, I'm a big mindfulness person, a big believer in mindfulness. So even if you're not an educator, although if you're an educator, please, there's plenty for you. But I also spend a lot of time on the self-care piece in general. If you go to my website, which is www.youre3eyes.com, your3eyes.com. You can join my newsletter. That's a great way to start. You can learn about stuff. But there's also, I have meditations and other ways to connect with me there, blogs and other resources. And yeah, I love helping people just to feel a little bit better and feel a bit more connected with them, with their that head, heart, body thing. So would love to support anybody out there.
Awesome. And thank you all for listening today. Hopefully you're able to get something out of this discussion. As always, please feel free to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at Touchy Subs Pod. Please email any questions, comments, or concerns to touchysubjectspodcast@gmail.com.
And in the meantime, don't be afraid to challenge, ask, and discuss when it comes to touchy subjects.